from Montana to Alabama, Texas to Vermont, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has set itself up as regulator, judge, and jury in a dispute with the makers of baby safety products. Kathy Hoekstra has details on this month's American Heroes. New statistics show inflation is down and employment levels are up. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. President Donald Trump is pushing hard to oust Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. But does replacing Powell make sense? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the issue with Ryan Young of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And recent statistics released by U-Haul show people continue to move from high-tax states to low-tax states. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. LeachCo, makers of a wide array of baby safety products, finds itself in a regulatory dispute with the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which is adjudicating its own rulings. Kathy Hoekstra from the Pacific Legal Foundation talks with Jamie Leach of LeachCo on this installment of American Heroes.
When federal regulators can label a safe product dangerous with no proof, drag its makers through years of in-house prosecution, lose on the facts, appeal the loss to itself with zero consequences to themselves, something is seriously broken and very unconstitutional. Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Hoekstra with Pacific Legal Foundation. Joining me today is Jamie Leach, a self-described innovationer and co-founder of LeachCo Incorporated, an Oklahoma-based business that's helped families keep babies safer for nearly four decades. Jamie is also an American hero. That is, a PLF client battling government abuse so severe, it's cost her family their business and put everyone's due process rights at risk. Jamie, thank you so much for your courage and for being here.
Hi, Kathy. It's nice to be with you today. Thank you for asking me.
Well, I'd love to begin with LeachCo's origins because it really is a classic American story. It starts back in 1988 with you, a registered nurse, your seven-month-old son, and a restaurant high chair.
That's exactly right. I was working as a registered nurse, and my husband and I had a seven-month-old. He was an active infant, as they say. And I had to go out of town to a conference. My husband went with me to help me take care of the baby, and we went to a restaurant we'd never been to before. We got stuck with a defective high chair where there was no strap to hold him in place, and he was like a monkey all over that chair. So I thought, I'm just going to take my purse strap off, wrap it around him just to hold him in place so he doesn't slide out. That kind of held him in there. He started to slip out and I caught him and I thought, I'm making something. And so I sat down that evening and started cutting out some fabric. And with a prayer that I quoted for wisdom and inspiration, came up with our original product called the Wiggle Wrap. And I took it to a friend who was a seamstress and took a potholder and had her sew it on the front of it for decoration. And I took that everywhere. And that held him in place. And that started LeachCo in May of 1988.
And you continued creating and designing products and manufacturing them and just putting dozens of products on the market. In 2009, you introduced another LeachCo original, the Podster Infant Lounger. And like everything else you designed, Amy, safety came first. Clear warnings, user instructions, the whole nine yards. And the Podster was a huge hit for 13 years. Then the federal government came after the Podster and you.
So the Podster was a very popular product. It was not for sleep. It had never been marketed for sleep. And it was an item that just gave parents a hands-free kind of friend while they're doing things with under the supervision, watching their baby. And there was an incident after several years that was a daycare center that had violated every state law, their own laws within the daycare center, and an infant tragically died as a result of that negligence, and the Podster was present.
The Consumer Product Safety Commission decided to come after you.
That's right. We were notified that they were doing an investigation on the Podster. And we asked them, what did we do wrong? What were the violations? Where did we not do what was required? We'd followed all the federal guidelines for testing, labeling, warnings, and everything was okay. They just did not want it on the market. So we asked them, could we have a telephone conference about it, a Zoom meeting? Would you meet with us for maybe a retrofit? Under no circumstances would they even meet with us. And they had told us if we don't recall the product, they were going to issue a unilateral press release against us and the Podster. We weren't going to recall it because we had not done anything wrong. And there was nothing defective about this product. So we refused, and they issued a unilateral press release that went up on their website. And then every major news organization, TV station, NBC, CBS, the Today Show, issued this. This was dangerous, that it was had the potential for injuring and killing infants. And our reputation as our company that we had built over 35 years was destroyed in seconds.
The agency didn't even say that the project was malfunctioning or broke. They basically said, oh, somebody might misuse it. And by that logic, almost anything can be deemed dangerous. And the really awful part is they decided to go after you legally, but they didn't go to a court of law. They took their case in-house, held a so-called trial in its own offices, not a regular court before a regular jury, instead an administrative law judge, and going by their own rules instead of the rules that they use in a regular court, basically said, no, actually, there is no defect. And they wanted to throw the case out. And then the agency says, we're going to appeal it. And the way they appeal it is with themselves. And even worse, despite the massive enforcement powers this agency has, the commissioners who make all these decisions, they're not elected by anyone, and they face zero accountability because the president cannot remove them except for cause. So with free representation by PLF, you're fighting back on two fronts, the agency that refuses to take the L it got and deserves, and second, in federal court, arguing the CPSC is an unconstitutional agency that conducts unconstitutional proceedings and violated your rights to due process. What made you decide, let's go, it's lawsuit time?
Well, as you said, these are not elected officials. These are employees that are making the decision about what businesses makes it or doesn't, who's going to succeed and who isn't. We are not a huge corporation. We're a small family business located in rural Oklahoma. And within a very short amount of time, trying to defend ourselves against the federal government, who can print their own money and have unlimited resources for infinite time. We were out of cash pretty quickly and facing a very sad end to our company. We were notified that someone from Pacific Legal Foundation was interested in talking with us, and we met with them, and they offered to provide legal counsel and defend us against this. Without them, we wouldn't have had any way to defend ourselves or tell our story. We've already lost everything. We had to cease operations in September of 25. And that was after having a very successful business, family business, where all our children work. Here, my husband and I together built this up from nothing.
Your victory actually came in July 2024, but then, as we said, the agency promptly appealed and still has not made a decision on its own appeal. And in the meantime, the federal case has effectively been on hold the entire time because the federal court's also waiting for the appeal decision, as well as the Supreme Court's decision in a case argued in December called Slaughter versus Trump, involving the president's ability to remove powerful unelected bureaucrats as well. And of course, the government shutdown didn't help either, but the CPSC says it's finally getting back to work and could have a decision by mid-February. So the fight goes on. Jamie, I wish we could talk so much longer. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us. You can learn more about LeachCo versus the Consumer Product Safety Commission and all the work we're doing at PLF at pacificlegal.org. I will be back next month with another courageous American hero. I'm Kathy Hoekstra for American Radio Journal. Thank you for listening to American Heroes with Kathy Hoekstra, brought to you by Pacific Legal Foundation. If you've experienced government overreach like the stories we share here, please contact me at AmericanHeroes@pacificlegal.org. We're here to help.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We have a lot of new statistics relative to economic indicators, a lot of good news, and impact of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act about to hit. We're going to talk about all those things with Scott Parkinson. Scott, always great to have you here.
Thank you, Loman.
Inflation, of course, is something that was rampantly out of control under the Biden administration, over 21% over his 4 years in office. It's a big issue. Affordability is a big issue. Have we seen any progress on the inflation front?
Well, I definitely think we have, and the data doesn't lie on this as well. We're all the way down to 2.7% for monthly inflation levels, and that reached over 9% during the Biden years after he passed his stimulus spending bill and sort of the big government agenda that the left wanted underneath Joe Biden. I think that the inflationary levels today are giving the Federal Reserve even more confidence to reduce their interest rates. We've seen a few interest rate cuts since September, and obviously I think we're optimistic that the economy will sustain a couple more in 2026. That could do a lot for housing. It can do a lot for lending. It can do a lot for investment. It can really do a lot, I think, to increase the overall health of the U.S. economy. We're looking right now at other good indicators. Weekly jobless claims are below 200,000 people. We know that the unemployment rate is all the way down to 4.4%. I think we'd like to see that go a little bit lower, but obviously it's much improved from where we were just a few years ago. And then another measure that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out is the labor participation rate, and that's pretty steady around 62%. So it's not as weak of a job market and economy as some people would lead you to believe in the mainstream media. I think that the Trump administration has been taking steps to really put the economy in a good situation where hopefully we have sort of this economic boom over the next 3 years of the Trump administration.
Of course, Scott, all of this has to be felt at the kitchen table as well, and that takes a little bit of time. Can you talk for a minute or two here about provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and how those provisions are going to start impacting American families?
Well, there's one provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that I think has the strongest macroeconomic effects for a tax policy, and that's the ability to do 100% expensing and 100% bonus depreciation when it comes to your capital investments as a business. So what that basically means is you can write down your tax liability 100% for an asset that you're acquiring. Let's say that you're a manufacturer and you're buying new equipment or you're buying new structures. Those capital investments can be written off in your tax liability and really give those job creators the ability hire more workers, increase productivity. Ultimately, when you do those things, you increase your wages, you increase the number of jobs that you've got in your business, and it provides for environment of strong growth. This week, the Treasury Department issued guidance on the bonus depreciation and full expensing provisions of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and they're letting all these job creators know that the regulation, the clarification, the rules that are coming out as it pertains to this section of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act law are very, very consistent with the environment that we had after the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017. I think all this is tremendous news because we were seeing a big boom in the economy in those early years of 2018 and 2019 until we got to COVID and then the economy really shuttered and we saw big government lockdowns really thwart the ability for entrepreneurs to even keep their doors open. So ultimately, I do think that the full expensing guidance and the 100% bonus depreciation stuff that we saw out of Treasury this week is welcomed news for job creators. And hopefully we see that growth ahead of the 2026 midterm, so it has a big effect on where the economy is at.
I guess that is sort of the big question, Scott. If you look back historically, Ronald Reagan, when he came into office, he inherited an economy that was in recession, really, from the Carter administration. he and the Congress at that time took a number of steps, but in 1982, in the midterms, those steps had not yet perked through the economy. People hadn't felt it yet. Republicans took a big loss. A year later, of course, it was literally morning in America. Do you think the Trump administration has moved more quickly and fast enough so that this is going to be felt by voters before we hit the fall?
I think there are thousands of patriots in the Trump administration that are working every day with that goal in mind. And I think it's going to continue to get better. We have people that are dedicated to improving the lives of all Americans in all communities. And, of course, the media wants to cover the controversies that they are trying to sort of formulate. I think that there's been sort of a much ado about nothing when it comes to controversies with the Trump administration. But there's other big things that are part of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, too, that are going to have an impact on a lot of families, and one of those is the big school choice provision.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Speaking of the Club for Growth, tell us a little bit about it.
We are based out of Washington, D.C. We believe in these ideas of economic freedom, liberty, and opportunity, and that includes the big idea of school choice and school freedom. If you want to learn more about the policies that we're advocating for, you can visit clubforgrowth.org, where you can actually sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. As always, Scott, we appreciate your taking time to be with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
One way or another, Jerome Powell is going to be out as chairman of the Federal Reserve this spring. But does replacing him make sense? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Ryan Young of the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
The Justice Department this week announced that it has opened a criminal investigation into Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell. And this is, I think, widely seen as the latest attempt by the Trump administration to force Powell to resign or step aside or allow the president to put someone else in charge of the Federal Reserve, which, of course, is the central bank responsible for setting interest rates for the entire country. Should we be concerned about this attempt by the president to push out Jerome Powell, or should conservatives and libertarians be eager to see the Federal Reserve operate less independently? That's the question that I will put to my guest today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. That aforementioned guest is Ryan Young, friend of the show and a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He joins us again to talk about this big news this week. Ryan, thanks for taking some time and joining us here.
Thank you, Eric.
The Trump Justice Department has opened this investigation into Powell. Powell says this is a pretext just to get him out of power. I'm looking at this and sort of inclined to agree with him, given Trump's kind of ongoing attempts to influence the Federal Reserve or push Powell out. What's your take on the news here?
It is 100% political. You may recall a few months ago, President Trump did something similar with Lisa Cook, who is a member of the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. He tried to get her out of office, had a criminal investigation. The case flopped. The charges didn't stick because there was no substance to them, and it was, like this case, transparently political. So my guess is that if the president couldn't get charges to stick against a regular member of the Board of Governors, he's not going to be able to get something to stick against the chairman of the Federal Reserve. But all the same, message sent.
Yeah, message sent loud and clear. There's a couple funny things here that we should just note. One is that the charges here, or the investigation, I should say, there's no charges yet, has to do with renovations that happened at the Federal Reserve. And then also, Trump appointed Powell in the first place back during his first term. I think, you know, it's tempting maybe for some people to look at this and say, well, the president should have whoever, he should have his own guy in there in the Federal Reserve. Like, Jerome Powell is the president's guy, or at least he was.
Yeah. The trouble is the Federal Reserve is independent, and the president has a long-standing preference for low interest rates and easy money that long predates his entrance to politics, let alone Powell's chairmanship in the Federal Reserve. And since Powell is putting up some resistance, he's more inclined to take a look at the data and see where that leads him. And I certainly have my policy disagreements with Powell as well, but when it comes to setting interest rate policy, who makes the decision is actually a lot more important than what the made.
Yeah, and I think that's the real crux of the issue. So let's get into that here. I mean, Trump wants to see lower interest rates. He's been saying that for months. He thinks the economy is doing really well and the Fed should be moving quicker to lower rates. The Fed has brought rates down a bit, obviously not as fast as the president would like. What is it that the Fed is looking at? What is it that Powell is looking at? And why are they not moving as quickly as Trump would like?
Well, the Fed has to navigate a set of trade-offs, and most politicians don't even know what the word trade-off means. When you lower interest rates, you can stimulate the economy. That's good. But the trade-off of stimulus now is inflation later. And that's why the Federal Reserve, when they lower rates, they do it reluctantly, and they don't do it by very much, because they're trying to thread that needle between trying to, say, compensate for a labor market that's showing some cracks, but at the same time, with inflation being too high and the president's tariffs not helping with that, also trying to keep inflation under control. So they're somewhere between a rock and a hard place. And the president just wants stimulus, stimulus, stimulus. He has midterm elections coming up. The Republican majority is in danger. And doesn't care as much about what trade-offs might come later. He just wants stimulus now.
Yeah, of course, the interest rates went up in response to the inflation that happened during the Biden administration, and inflation is still high. I mean, this is something that people are concerned about for sure, and then the data says this too. We're up around 3%. We're up well above that 2% threshold that is really the Fed's benchmark where they try to get inflation back down to. We're talking with Ryan Young, senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about all of this political back and forth between the White House and the Federal Reserve. And Ryan, I think that you hit on this a minute ago. I want to finish on this point, which is that the interest rates, yes, are important. Setting them is important, but who sets them and how independent the Fed is also quite important. And look, as a libertarian, I don't love the Federal Reserve. I wish it was more of a market-based system. But I think, should we be worried about a precedent that's set here where a president or any political leader gets to just decide what interest rates are going to be going forward?
Precedent has already been set in places like Peron-era Argentina or in Turkey today, and it's 38% inflation rate, or in Russia, which has inflation rate, I believe, north of 20%. Whenever you have politicians in charge of a central bank, you get high inflation, you have massive deficit spending that they attempt to use the printing press to pay off. It's a disaster everywhere it's been tried, and it's been tried in a lot of places. We should not try that here in America. But if we're going to have a Federal Reserve, and I'm with you on that point, it needs to be as independent as you can possibly make it. Who makes a decision matters a lot more than what the decision is, and markets are bearing that out right now.
Yeah, certainly I think there are ways we could improve the Federal Reserve or the way we set interest rates. This doesn't strike me as a way to improve it. This strikes me, as you just said, Ryan, as a step towards Argentina, the bad days in Argentina, or a bunch of other terrible examples throughout history. Artificially low interest rates means artificially high inflation, folks. Those two things, you just can't get away from that. We are unfortunately out of time for today. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Eric.
And once again, that is Ryan Young. He's a senior economist at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Check out his work online at CEI.org. He wrote this week about this very topic, an excellent piece you should check out there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Texas and Florida, two states without a personal income tax, are leading the nation in population growth. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
In the early weeks of 2026, what can we expect as it relates to the economy this year? Public debate remains focused on affordability. Americans are still absorbing the consequences of price increases that grew out of control during the Biden administration. In 2022, inflation never fell below 6.5% and peaked at an incredibly high 9.1% in June of that year. Americans noticed. People balancing their budgets at their kitchen tables watched groceries, rent, and utilities consume an ever greater share of their income. Yet our economy continues now to show indications of strength. Americans will see significant tax relief with the Working Family Tax Relief Act that was signed into law by President Donald Trump in 2025. We will see gains in productivity, continued strong GDP growth in the last two quarters, and inflation that has cooled dramatically from its recent peaks during the Biden years. However, what differs sharply across the country is not the national economy, of course, but state policies that have driven a wide economic divergence between rich states and poor states. Some states continue to position themselves as places where ordinary people can still get ahead. Others continue to enact policies that make basic necessities more expensive and economic mobility more difficult. Of course, the most direct way for policymakers to leave more money in people's pockets is to take less of it in the first place. That reality is reflected in human behavior. According to the recently released U-Haul Growth Index, which tracks the balance of inbound versus outbound one-way truck rentals, states with competitive tax policies that lead to more affordability continue to attract residents. Texas and Florida, two states without personal income taxes, again lead the nation in inbound movers. North Carolina ranks third, and Tennessee, another state without a personal income tax, fourth. At the other end of the list are California, Illinois, New Jersey, and New York. These four states, long committed to high taxes and heavy regulation, also lead the nation in outbound moves. This is not coincidence. People respond to incentives even when policymakers pretend otherwise. Such patterns are examples of Americans voting with their feet. Families and businesses migrate towards jurisdictions that allow them to keep more of what they earn and impose fewer regulatory obstacles. Human capital flows to where it can be used most productively, offering a clearer verdict on policy than any political talking point. During the COVID period, when remote work expanded dramatically, many Americans discovered that moving could function as an immediate boost to affordability. Predictably, many did. Affordability extends well beyond taxes. Consider even things like water and sewer costs, which are highest in states like Maryland, Washington, Hawaii, and Connecticut. Maryland residents pay on average more than three times what residents pay in the lowest cost states, Alabama, Tennessee, South Carolina, and West Virginia. These differences do not arise from geography alone, but from policy choices and regulatory structures at the state level. Energy costs tell a similar story, depending on the choices of your state policymakers. States that pursue government-directed ideas around energy as an overriding objective, with carbon taxes, cap-and-trade policies, the radical ESG ideology, have driven electricity prices sharply upward. California, Massachusetts, and Connecticut now charge more than 21 cents per kilowatt hour for electricity. In contrast, states like Utah, Idaho, North Dakota, and Wyoming charge less than 9 cents, less than half as much. The consequences are borne not by slogans, but by households paying monthly bills. Housing costs are perhaps the most visible component of the affordability discussion. Prices have risen nationwide and strain household budgets. Some factors, like supply restrictions and property tax burdens, are driven by state and local government decisions, respectively. While affordability challenges are real in many parts of the country, they are generally driven by failed big government policies. In contrast, we have some refreshing national tailwinds with federal tax relief and deregulation driving costs lower, and free market states are doubling down with policies that bring more affordability. As with our great experiment with federalism, Americans are free to choose, and they continue to choose states that value freedom. For more information, you can go to alec.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KXRA-AM in Alexandria, Minnesota, KAYQ-FM in Warsaw, Missouri, along with WWOW-AM in Conneaut, Ohio. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of interviews aired on this program, please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.